Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. We're now at episode 16 of this 20-part history of the Catholic Church. As we've gone along, I've been aware that perhaps we're getting a little bit bogged down, but I did warn you that as we moved forward, things would get more and more complicated because, well, as history moves on, there's more history. And in the last episode, you might remember, we were dealing with the 14th century from 1300 to 1400, and also trying to deal with and explain some of the philosophical events that were happening in the High Middle Ages, the work of Thomas Aquinas and the other philosophers, and the turmoil that was going on as the universities were established. It was important to go into those details, even though I'm not by any stretch a philosopher, to understand, therefore, the philosophical background for a couple of hundred years before events which will finally boil over into the Reformation, which is what we'll be talking about in the next session in episode 17. In the meantime, though, we're dealing with the 15th century, the events from 1400 to 1500. And again, what we're going to see is that there's something happening on the surface, and the history on the surface is very much the story of the popes and the politics and the princes and all of those machinations of power and prestige and popularity or unpopularity, depending on how it goes. But as we've seen all the way through, the Holy Spirit is doing something else in the hearts and the lives of people at the grassroots level, at the local level. Other things are happening. Other things are brewing. Other things are bubbling away, which reflect what's going on in the higher levels of authority and in government and in the politics of the time. And the two kind of hold hands. It's almost like the outward history and then the inward history. And the inward history is really very interesting because, as we've gone along, we've seen that the inward history as the Roman Empire dwindled and fell was the rise of the monastic movement. And as the papacy went through its ups and downs, the monastic movement in the Middle Ages continued to grow and continued to flourish. The missionary movements continued to grow and to flourish. So the church is growing and changing and developing at the grassroots level, while at the same time in the political level, on the level of the princes and the popes, if you like, the political intrigue continues. And we're going to see that especially now in the 15th century as certain currents come together, both on the external political side of things, but also on the internal side, on the intellectual and the spiritual side of things. We're going to see how they're developing and moving towards a climax, which in many ways is disastrous for the Catholic Church, but is turns out in the end to be, while it's one of the tragedies, turns out also then to be one of the triumphs. And this is the paradox all the way through this series on the history of the Catholic Church, is to see how God is constantly turning what seem to be disasters into triumphs for the Church, turning things around even though they seem, from a human point of view, to be a total tragedy. And he brings it around through the work of the Holy Spirit in a great way. So in order to really understand what's happening from 1400 to 1500 in the 15th century, we have to go back again and review some of the things which were going on just before that. Now, you might remember that in the 14th century, we were dealing with the Avignon papacy. The papacy had moved to France, and the popes had set up there because of the politics and the violence in the Italian peninsula, the violence and the manipulations of the families in Rome and Florence and elsewhere in the different city-states. The Pope was unable to remain in Rome, and so he went to Avignon. And there, under the influence of the French king, a kind of French papacy developed. And that developed all the way through the 14th century, until finally, right towards the end of the 14th century, the Pope Gregory the 11th, who was a good pope and wanted to do the right thing, was encouraged by Catherine of Siena to return to Rome. And so Gregory the 11th comes back to Rome, and I'm going to go through very quickly the events which happened after that, because I think I mentioned them before about the Great Schism, but we're going to go through it again very quickly to understand exactly what happened. When Gregory the 11th dies in Rome, The Roman crowds are once more saying, give us an Italian, give us an Italian. We want to have an Italian pope. We don't want the French here anymore. And so they actually campaign loudly for this Italian pope, almost threatening the cardinals with violence, you know, saying if you come in the streets, if you don't elect an Italian or a Roman, you're going to be torn apart. And so the cardinals elected the Archbishop of Bari, Bartholomew Prignano. And they thought he would be a sensible, diplomatic kind of a pope. He seemed to be a good man when he was actually serving as a bishop. But he turned out to be crazy, a kind of tyrant who imposed his will on everyone in the Vatican. This would have been in 1378. And so the cardinals decide to depose the very pope that they've elected. Bartholomew Prignano took the name Urban VI, and so the cardinals got together very shortly after his election and deposed Urban VI. And so Urban VI wasn't going to have this, so he appointed some new cardinals. And the cardinals, instead of Urban VI, elected another pope, Clement VII. But Clement VII was a Frenchman, so he goes back to Avignon with the cardinals who had elected him, and we now have the beginning of the Great Schism. Well, the schism continues on for an amazing almost 30 years, and as I explained before, the entire Catholic Church was divided. The different countries in Europe chose different allegiances to the two different popes. Urban VI in Rome died and was succeeded by Boniface IX. Boniface IX dies and is succeeded in 1406 by Gregory XII. And we're now at the beginning of the 15th century, and the Great Schism is continuing on. Meanwhile, in Avignon, Clement VII had died and was succeeded by Benedict XIII. And you can see, as the Great Schism continues, it's getting worse and worse, because these rival popes are appointing rival bishops and rival archbishops, and the schism is not just that there's two popes. There's beginning to be two churches in each in allegiance to a separate pope, and the schism goes right down to the grassroots level, where individual bishops of dioceses are therefore appointing competing members to different parishes and different monasteries, and the whole thing gets worse and worse. So in 1409, finally, the rulers of Europe get together with some of the laymen and some of the minor clergy and the others and some of the cardinals and bishops, and they say, we're going to have a council, and the council is going to decide who is going to try to solve this problem of the Great Schism. Now, this is really interesting, because what we see rising here is called conciliarism. The idea, which was totally new, that a council could actually decide who the pope would be, to depose a pope or elect a new pope, not just the cardinals. How could you resolve the schism between the two popes if each of them had their own their own cardinals? It was impossible. So the Council of Pisa is drawn together, and they try to convince Benedict XIII, the French pope, and Gregory XII, the Roman pope, to resign. And both of the popes kind of come along meekly as lambs to start with, and say, oh yes, we'll definitely resign, but I will as soon as you do. In other words, when Gregory says, if Benedict resigns, then I will respond and resign as well. But of course, neither was willing to jump first. The Council of Pisa got together, and they formally deposed both of the popes and declared them to be notorious heretics and schismatical and everything bad you can imagine. And they elected Peter Filigari. And he was the Cardinal of Milan, 70 years old, with an excellent reputation, and he takes the name of Alexander V. But the problem is that the other two popes weren't really willing to stand down, and therefore there were now three popes: Alexander V, the one who had just been elected, and Gregory XII, the Roman Pope, and Benedict XIII, the French Pope. Alexander V didn't even manage to get to Rome. He died on his way there, and his successor took the name John XXIII. Now, remember, you might remember John the 23rd as the Pope from the 1960s. That's because this John the 23rd in history is considered to be an anti-pope and not a real pope. That's why when John the 23rd was elected in the 1960s, he took the name John 23rd, even though this anti-pope this had been elected during the Great Schism. And so John the 23rd comes in and calls himself the Pope. And now into this torturous plot comes the Holy Roman Emperor, Sigismund of Luxembourg. And Sigismund of Luxembourg had been elected the Holy Roman Emperor, and he decides that he is going to call a council. And this is the Council of Constance in 1414. And the Council of Constance, we're going to see, is actually very important. Sigismund calls the Council of Constance, he calls the popes to come together. John the 23rd, the one who'd just recently been elected, comes into the town on a white horse, clad in the vestments of the liturgy, with a golden canopy, followed by his cardinals and amid all the hosannas. And everyone thought that the Great Schism would be ended, and John the 23rd, as this new pope, was coming in, and the others would be deposed, and everything would be fine. The whole of Western Christendom was represented. There wasn't any place in the town to sleep. The place was crowded. There were 33 archbishops, 29 cardinals, more than 500 bishops, 100 abbots, 300 doctors of sacred science, and 18,000 other clerics. The place was the council was absolutely huge. And in his opening address, Pope John the 23rd defined the objectives as union and reform. In other words, the council was there not just to solve the problem of the council of the Great Schism, but the council was also called to try to reform the church. The church by this time had fallen back into its old ways of corruption in many ways, and there was a continued problem with simony, that is the selling of sacred offices, with immorality amongst the clergy, poor, low education amongst the clergy, and sexual corruption and immorality and financial corruption amongst the bishops and the cardinals and the rest of the church. So the fathers of the church here at the council decide that they are going to try to solve the problems, not just of the schism, but also of the reform. The only problem is that if they were going to vote, then the popes would be had stacked the voting according to their cardinals and the bishops. And so John the 23rd was assured that he was going to win because he brought the most delegates who could vote. Sigismund and some of the other leaders of the council got together and decided to outmaneuver him and said that the voting would be done according to national votes, a little bit like the American Electoral College. The entire country would vote one way or the other, rather than individual bishops. Well, John the 23rd realized that he was outmaneuvered. And so he realized if that happened, that he would have to abdicate. And so he promised to abdicate if the other popes did so as well. And so everybody thought this would be terrific, and they were singing the praises and alleluias. But John, disguised as a groom, escaped from Constance, followed by a considerable number of the dignitaries from his entourage, and found refuge with the Duke of Austria. Well, a great commotion broke out when the news emerged, and the mob pillaged the papal palace, and the whole thing might have been dispersed, except that Sigismund, the Roman Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, stepped up and urged everyone to remain and try to solve the problem. So the Council of Constance continues, and it was resolved that Pope John's departure changed nothing. They would still move forward with unity and with a reform as much as they could. Well, they tried the three popes and found them numerous of various crimes. And the pope of the Roman line, who, if you remember, was Gregory the 12th, he chose a dignified abdication. He actually was the first to resign. John the 23rd was taken back to Constance and tried by the council and deposed formally. And the Avignon Pope was the one who resisted. He moved to Spain with his cardinals, and they held out there to the end, but no one took any notice. They had been deposed by the Council of Constance effectively. And the Council of Constance then went forward to elect Pope Martin V. And Pope Martin V, being elected, therefore, is the Pope who ends this great schism. Well, the important thing about the Council of Constance is to remember that they were also trying to reform the Church at the same time. And they were trying to reform the Church, but it was difficult because of the very nature of simony, the very nature of the financial corruption, the very nature of these other corruptions in the Church, meant that everybody had a vested interest. You see, along with the simony went the problem of pluralism. This was where a man could own more than one benefice. A benefice was an appointment to a particular job. So, and the benefices were all over Europe. So you could have the benefice of a particular parish, like St. Hilda's Throckmorton or something like that, and you would receive the tithe income from that particular parish. So it was a job which had an income associated with it. But pluralism meant that if you were favored by the bishop or by the archbishop, he would give you more than one benefice. So one man, for instance, could be the vicar of Throckmorton, but at the same time, he might hold the office of the abbot of Silesia, which is in Germany, and he could also be the bishop of Worcester in England, and maybe he would be also hold a priory of some priory in Spain. It didn't matter. If you got the title, you got the income. And pluralism was therefore a great corruption in the Church, and those people who were well-connected got more of the benefices and therefore more of the income from these various benefices and grew very wealthy. You might say, well, how did they do the job? Well, very often they didn't do the job, and that was one of the other corruptions. But those who were conscientious would use some of the money that they got from the benefice to pay a priest who was on the lower, much lower in the food chain, to go and do the work. And this is what a curate was. A curate or a vicar was someone who stood in vicariously for the one who held the benefice, and they would do the job. They would do the preaching and the baptizing and administer the sacraments. But very often these men were very ignorant and very immoral themselves, and from the lower classes and very uneducated. And so this corruption perpetuated the class system and perpetuated the division between rich and poor. And it was just a corruption in the Church, because what along with this simony and the pluralism was another problem, which was absenteeism, which means that the priest who held the benefice was not actually resident in the abbey where he was supposed to be the abbot, or in the diocese where he was meant to be the bishop, or in the parish where he was meant to be the parish priest. And so these corruptions were some of the things which the Council of Constance wanted to reform. In addition to that, there was the crisis and the scandal of the papal tax collectors during the Great Schism. Both popes had a system of taxing the people and had their own tax collectors and their own system. And very often, if you fell in the wrong place in the wrong locality, both popes and both tax collectors for the both popes would try to be collecting taxes from you at the same time. All of this combined with ignorance, immorality, and scandal through the Church called for the Council of Constance to try to bring about reform. But while the Council succeeded in bringing about unity and ending the Great Schism, the Council of Constance in 1414 did not succeed in reforming the Church, because, as I said, everybody had a vested interest. Nobody was willing to give up their piece of the pie. Nobody was willing to give up the benefices which they had received through this corrupt system. And so the corrupt system continued, and actually continued to get worse. Therefore, as we move into the second half of the 15th century, we start coming into the period of what are called the Renaissance popes. There was a great flowering of learning, which developed, of course, by the as a consequence of the of the development of the universities. And as the classical learning became more commonplace with the discovery of Aristotle and more of the classical texts coming about, there was this great resurgence of culture and a great flowering of art in the Renaissance, largely going back and trying to learn from the riches and the glories of Greece and Rome. And the Renaissance was therefore a resurgence of not only the philosophy of Greece, but also the art and the architecture. So this kind of classical form started to come into the church, and along with it came a very high level of affluence as the cities and the towns continued to grow. And along with the affluence, of course, continued to be the decadence in the church. And so as we move into the middle of the 15th century, we see the flowering of the Renaissance popes. These were, again, as we had seen 500 years before in the 9th and 10th centuries, the papacy starts to become a very wealthy plum for Roman families to fight over. And therefore, with Pope Eugenius IV, the breakdown of the breakdown of the conciliar movement began. After the Council of Constance, the conciliar movement, as it's called, continued to plow on through the 15th century as people believed that there was a council. We needed a council to reform the church. But the more the council tried to reform the church, the more they clashed with the popes, because the popes had a vested interest as well. And finally, with a clash between Eugenius IV, the pope, and the council, the conciliar system broke down, and more support went to the pope, and we began to see the flowering again of a very wealthy and a very powerful papacy. Not all of it was bad. A number of the popes used their power to bring in basic reforms, and they did other good things. Pope Nicholas V, for instance, who was pope in the middle of the century, in the 1450s, was a great builder. He came into Rome and found that the city of Rome had fallen into decay. Fired by the inspiration of the classical movement with the Greeks and the Romans, he began to rebuild Rome. He restored the Pantheon, for instance. He restored various of the ancient Roman sites. He began a new building program. He started to try to restore and repair the ancient Basilica of St. Peter, which had been there since Constantine's time in the 4th century. And Pope Nicholas V was also a great lover of books and a great lover of learning. He's the one who began to build up the Vatican Library. He began to build up the Vatican art collections. Therefore, he did, as a Renaissance pope, was not totally decadent. He was doing a lot of good things in the area of the arts and the culture to build up the Catholic Church. He was succeeded by Pope Callistus and then by Pope Pius II through the 1450s and the beginning of the 1460s. And with these popes, we see the flowering of what's called the Renaissance papacy. But the ones who come right after them are the ones who are the most famous. Sixtus, Pope Sixtus IV, becomes pope in 1471. And he continues the work of Nicholas V. He's also a great patron of the arts and a great patron of architecture. And Pope Sixtus IV is the one who commissioned, for instance, the building of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. Sistine Chapel simply goes back to his name, Sixtus. And Sixtus built the Sistine Chapel. And the Sistine Chapel, therefore, is one of his architectural achievements. And there's others around Rome where Sixtus was a patron of the arts. He also built up commissioned and was a patron of composers and built up the chapel of the choir of the Sistine Chapel, and he's then followed by Pope Innocent VIII in 1492, and Innocent VIII was a great lover of feasting and a great lover of drama. And by now, this Renaissance papacy is becoming what we know as the Renaissance popes, who are cruel, lustful, and wicked men. Innocent VIII is followed by the Borgia Pope, Alexander VI. And Alexander VI is the pope right at the turn of the century, from the 1400s into the 1500s. And we're going to begin with him next time and talk about the Borgia papacy and the ones who followed after him, which helped to lead into the crisis that we're going to see in the 16th century. So these popes, these Renaissance popes, were a mixed bag. They brought in lots of good accomplishments in rebuilding Rome and in building up the cultural heritage of the church, and also trying to bring in reform in their own way, but they also yielded to the temptations of power and privilege, of prosperity and pleasure, and gave themselves over to that in a way which is going to bring about what we'll see later, the Protestant Reformation. So, before we conclude, I said that we're talking about the surface level of the popes and the power and the politics, but remember, there's always this grassroots movement going on. There's a terrific book out there which is called The Great Medieval Heretics by Michael Forseto. And in this book, he traces how from the 10th century onward, there were little reform movements at the grassroots level. So people like the Bogomils, and also Cosmas the Presbyter in the 10th century, these were kind of like proto-Franciscans. They were committed to living together in community. They were committed to the simple gospel. They were committed to living the apostolic life out in the country and so forth in a semi-monastic way. But they also drifted into various heresies. We talked about the Albigensians, for instance, who were stamped out by the Dominicans and the Inquisition. There were others, Henry the Monk, Stephen and Lisieux, and the Valdes and the Waldensians, Fra Dolcino and the Apostolici in Italy, various different primitivist movements that were returning to a simple spirituality and to a simple return to the gospel and preaching the gospel and living in common. But because they were grassroots, they were uneducated for the most part, they were dismissed as heretics, as schismatics, and the church suppressed them, and they didn't come to much. However, when we go back to the 14th century, we see that this same spirit of primitivism, going back to the basics, going back to the Bible, going back to the simple teachings of Jesus, starts to develop in a way which is going to lay the roots for the Reformation. And that character in the 14th century is an Englishman called John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe is an Oxford theologian, and he is born around 1330. And he is a very brilliant linguist, a very brilliant theologian and philosopher. And he was influenced, interestingly, by William of Ockham, also an Oxford scholar. And you might remember from last episode, William of Ockham was the philosopher who reduced everything to the simplest conditions with what he called Ockham's razor. And William of Ockham was a nominalist who did away with all of the ideas that there's an invisible world, a spiritual world that you can't see that parallels this world and so forth, and simply said, no, let's focus on what you can see. Interestingly enough, William of Ockham influences the thought of John Wycliffe. And John Wycliffe therefore goes back to the basics and says becomes a great critic of the opulence of the clergy, the corruption of the clergy. He's also a critic, interestingly, of the Eucharist, begins to criticize the Catholic understanding of the Eucharist with transubstantiation. He also is a biblicist. He translates the Bible into English, and he wants to go back to the Bible and back to the simple gospel. And therefore, he's criticizing all of the problems I spoke about. He's criticizing the corruption, the power of the clergy. And he's backed up, interestingly, by the political powers in England, because he is constantly sticking up for the power of the king, the power of the political, the secular power, and saying that the church power is only supposed to be spiritual power. Now, this runs parallel to what is going to come forward within conciliarism, where the ones who are running the council said, the popes have enough power, we're going to say what happens. At the same time, Wycliffe is active during the years of the Great Schism. And the Great Schism actually weakened the power of the papacy, because they were so involved in the fighting between themselves that people like John Wycliffe, who eventually took a more and more extreme view and became more and more heretical, was able to continue because he had the backing of the political powers in England, and the popes, who were far away in Rome and in Avignon, couldn't be bothered with the writings of this brilliant theologian and linguist far away in Oxford. Well, the other interesting thing about John Wycliffe is that He continues his writing, which become more and more extreme. And then finally, in 1377, he is censured by the church, by Pope Gregory XII, and he loses more and more support, and he dies finally in his vicarage in Lutterworth in 1384, at the end of the 14th century. But there was a link between the King Richard in England, who had married Anne of Bohemia. And Bohemian scholars had come to Oxford to study, and they were becoming influenced by these radical writings of John Wycliffe. They go back to Bohemia, to the University of Prague, and in the universities in Bohemia, therefore, at the beginning of the 15th century, at the beginning of the 1400s, the ideas of John Wycliffe are beginning to percolate and beginning to become very popular, and the leader of this reform movement is a fellow called John Huss. John Huss steps forward from his university position and begins to promote the ideas of John Wycliffe, and is influenced by John Wycliffe's writings, which were increasingly anti-clerical, increasingly challenging the Catholic view of the Eucharist, challenging the Catholic view of the papacy and apostolic succession, and returning to the Bible in all of its simplicity. And John Huss steps forward as is sometimes called the morning star of the Reformation. John Huss in Bohemia, which is now the Czech Republic, in Eastern Europe, John Huss steps forward and begins to teach this radical reform. And now the radical reform is not just a simple movement of ignorant people like St. Francis was, and it's not just a movement of simple people living together in communes and becoming a little bit heretical because of their ignorance. Instead, this reform movement is backed up by sound scholarship, by a brilliant theologian and philosopher and linguist, John Wycliffe, from England, and also the university-educated dons in Prague and Bohemia. Therefore, the university system and the philosophers that we looked at in the last episode are now beginning to show the fruits of their studies and the fruits of their learning, because their learning has filtered down into the theology of John Wycliffe and the theology of John Huss, and is beginning to bring about the theological thought and the philosophical thought, which is laying the foundations for the Protestant Reformation. John Huss is not just censured. John Huss, at the this same Council of Constance in 1414, is condemned. His books are burnt, and John Huss himself is burnt at the stake as a heretic. So we get this hugely dramatic event of a Council of Constance bringing about the unity of the church, and also trying to reform the church from within, but not failing in punishing the heretic John Huss. John Huss is burned at the stake in 1415, and what happens in the rest of the 15th century is you can see the popes, the Renaissance papacy beginning to develop for the rest of this century, and the popes in Rome getting all tied up in the wealth that they have and commissioning artists and painters and architects and musicians and composers and rebuilding Rome and blithely going along their way with all these worldly pursuits, with all the wealth and the power that they were accumulating, and just being almost totally unaware of the revolt and the reform movement that's happening at the grassroots level, as more and more anger is growing up amongst the simple people who want to have a church that is honoring Jesus Christ, who want to get rid of the pluralism, want to get rid of the absenteeism, want to get rid of the simony, wants to get rid of the corruption. And this movement now is taking on a power not only from the political powers in Europe, but also the academic powers in Europe, as John Wycliffe and John Huss and their followers are actually very learned men who can defend all of the reasons for the reforms they're calling for. And after John Huss's burning at the stake, of course, that was counterproductive, as it usually is. His followers just went underground and began to become more fervent in their beliefs. And so all during this 15th century, while the popes are blithely recreating, rebuilding Rome and doing all these wonderful things in the Renaissance and in art and so forth, the Reformation is percolating away in the background. The anger and the push for real reform, the anger at the continued corruption, the anger at the tone deaf clergy and hierarchy who are living their sumptuous lives and being unaware that all the time at the grassroots, more and more there's more and more fomenting of rebellion and reform. During the same time, while the popes and the bishops had become more wealthy and corrupt, I'm afraid to say that the monasteries were also falling back into corruption, into indifference, into laziness, and many of the monasteries were also falling into this same worldliness and this same immorality and corruption. Of course, it wasn't all like that. It's much more complicated than I can give in an overview like this. But here we are at the end of the 15th century, at the dawn of at 1500. Rodrigo Borgia is taking the throne as Pope Alexander VI, which is going to lead us into the hugely dramatic events of the 16th century, with the Borgia popes on the throne in Rome, and the Martin Luther and the other reformers beginning to churn up all the problems which then result in the Reformation. But we'll get there next time in episode 17 of Triumphs and Tragedies. Before I go, I always like to reflect back a little bit on how this affects the times we live in today. You know, it was Archbishop Fulton Sheen who said that the church will be purified by the laity, not by the bishops. And we're seeing, as I record these episodes now in the summer of 2018, we're seeing what somebody's called the summer of shame, with the fall of Cardinal McCarrick, with the bishops rushing to cover their backs the best they can, and with the publication of the report on clergy abuse in the diocese in Pennsylvania over the last 7 decades. All of these things are coming out, as well as the rumors of homosexual abuse and homosexuality in the clergy in Chile and in Honduras and in Central America and Italy and in Germany, elsewhere, and the financial corruption and scandals that seems to always be surrounding this. I sometimes feel like we're living in the same time period now as in the 15th century, when these same troubles were brewing in the church, and the clergy, the hierarchy, seemed to be oblivious to what was going on, while the lay people were the ones who were calling for true reform and calling for a cleansing in the church. Well, we'll see how the Holy Spirit leads. I do feel in our own time, just like it was in the 15th century, that there are lots of grassroots movements where there's a real movement of the Holy Spirit and a real movement of faith. Things like the men's movement in the United States, with the men's conferences that are going on, with the movement of the Holy Spirit in different parishes, some of the renewal of the traditional religious orders, the Benedictine houses, the Dominicans, and so forth. Great things are happening. And so, while on one surface level we see corruption and we see immorality and problems, at the same time, God has never finished with His church. And I always remain hopeful and optimistic about what God is doing now and the seeds that He's planting now for a wonderful future as we move forward. This has been Triumphs and Tragedies, and you've been listening to episode 16. Thank you for bearing with me, and thank you for going along. If you would like to follow my blog, it's at Standing on My Head, DwightLongenecker.com. I write there every day on various things. Maybe you'll want to come along and read my blog posts, and also listen to my other podcast, which is called Stories of the Unexpected. Short little stories of the supernatural, the marvelous, the miraculous, and what it means in our lives today. I enjoy podcasting, and I've got some plans for podcasting some fiction in the future, some stories and some tales which are fictional, but which also help to strengthen our Catholic faith. So stay tuned to that. If you can be a donor subscriber to my blog, I encourage you to do so. At my blog, click on the tab that says subscribe. If with your monthly donation, you help me to make these podcasts available for thousands of people all over the world, and also make the blog post available to the thousands who read the blog every day. So thank you very much for your support. If you can go and be a donor subscriber, go to the blog, click on subscribe and sign up, and you'll read there where you also about the different benefits that I make available for my donor subscribers. Thank you very much for listening.